Okay, so I'm going to talk about soft hair on black holes. So the story starts with a triangle. And in the last 3 years, there's some nice steps to sit on over here. Laurent, okay. Over the last 3 years, an exact mathematical equivalence has been discovered between three disparate lines of investigation, which have each been developed over a period of a half a century to a century. And what are these different subjects? Well, one of them is asymptotic symmetries. And that could be thought of as beginning with the seminal work of Bondi, Vandenberg, Metzner, and Sachs. And they asked the question in 1962 of in what sense they thought that they were studying general relativity. And they asked the question, is there some sense in which general relativity at very long distances and weak fields reduces to special relativity? In other words, is there some kind of asymptotic symmetry group which acts at infinity in an isolated system that some subgroup of diffeomorphisms in general relativity, which is just the Poincaré group? And interestingly, the answer is no. There's no sense in which general relativity reduces to special relativity at long distances. And this already indicated the richness of this line of investigation, this big surprise, which I think we've only made sense of recently. But there are many other examples, famous example by Brown and Hanau in ADS3, of studying symmetries of which they're asymptotic in the sense that they are most simply represented in terms of how they act on the asymptotic scattering data of some space-time. Then the second subject is the so-called soft theorems in quantum field theory, which the modern form of them is Weinberg 1965, but really it goes back to Bloch and Nordzig in the 30s. And they take the form of let's consider some scattering amplitude in which one of the external particles is a massless particle like a photon or a graviton. And let's consider the limit when that particle goes to zero energy. And there turn out to be very special relationships between the soft limit of the amplitude with the massless particle and the same scattering amplitude without the particle. They're related by what's called a soft factor. And there are many stripes and forms, different kinds of soft theorems, and they've been a central subject in quantum field theory since its inception. Every calculation of a cross section at the LHC requires extensive use of the soft theorems to control and some Feynman diagrams. They're really kind of the bedrock of quantum field theory with massless fields. The third corner of this triangle is less developed than the other two, but still there's a substantial literature. Dates perhaps back to Zeldovich and Polnarev in the 70s. And the most famous example of it, again, is in gravity. And they noticed that, recently we saw at LIGO, the mirrors at LIGO when the gravity wave passed through, they oscillated. And that their positions oscillated like this. Now, actually, the mirrors are on pendula, but if they had been on tracks, at the end of the oscillation, they would not quite have returned to their original position. There would have been a net displacement. And this that's called the gravitational memory effect. And indeed, there are now a number of proposals, even at LIGO. They hope with more data that they will be able to, it is on a pendulum, but you might be able to measure the displacement before the pendulum swings back. And also using pulsar timing arrays, there are a variety of proposals for measuring this gravitational memory effect. Now, these three corners are, these three phenomena are related in a very direct way. And we'll talk about it in more detail. But basically, if we start from here, whenever you have a symmetry, you have Ward identities of those symmetries, which give you relationships between S matrix elements. And those relationships are nothing but the soft theorems in quantum field theory. So soft theorems are the Ward identities of symmetries. And the relationship between the soft theorems and the gravitational memory effect is even simpler. The gravitational memory effect is simply a Fourier transform in time. The soft theorem is a statement about low frequencies. The memory effect is a statement about long times. And the formulas are just Fourier transforms of one another. Here you have a pole, and the Fourier transform of a pole in frequency space is a step function in time. And that step function is the shift, the displacement that you see in the gravitational memory effect. Indeed, it's remarkable that we found a formula in a 87 paper of Broginski and Thorne, which was identical, even practically the notation was the same as the soft formula for the soft factor, soft graviton factor given by Weinberg in 1965. So these have the simplest relationship. And then the relationship between the asymptotic symmetries and the gravitational memory is that these asymptotic symmetries imply a vacuum degeneracy. And whenever you have in any non-trivial scattering process, the initial and the final vacuum will differ. And the gravitational memory effect is precisely measuring that change in the vacuum state. So, but relating these old subjects has given us new ways of thinking about unsolved problems and ideas for not just showing that old formulas were equivalent, but deriving new ones that we didn't know about before. And one of the things that we are trying to understand is that what are the implications of this triangle for the black hole information problem. So what I'm going to do, this will be most of the lecture, is I'm going to describe the basic ideas of this triangle in the context of electromagnetism. And just to show how it works. And then I'll give a lightning review of the black hole information paradox. And then I'll describe what we understand so far about what this implies for what this implies for black hole information. OK, so I'm going to start someplace extremely simple. I'm going to start with 19th century electromagnetism. And it turned out that there was something hidden in 19th century electromagnetism that I was unaware of until I'm sure Maxwell and Leonhard and Vicard, many people understood it, but it's something I was unaware of. It confused me for quite some time. So let me review it because it plays a crucial role in the discussion. So here is the field the radial electric field coming from a static charge. Now, if we boost it, the charge, the radial component of the electric field changes, and here's the formula, which you can find in Jackson. Now, or any other textbook on electromagnetism. It's called the Leonard-Weikert field. Now, the thing which is peculiar and going to be very important in what we're our discussion is that this boosted field is not single-valued near spatial infinity. It depends on how you go, what path you take to spatial infinity. So let's look at this. And so here, I want to talk about the behavior of fields at infinity. So I want to draw these Penrose diagrams, which bring infinity to finite points on the slide. And here I've drawn, this is past null infinity, the place where light rays come from. In this picture, light rays, forward-directed light rays, are moving at 45 degrees. So we have past null infinity and future null infinity. And this is what the trajectory of a boosted particle looks like. Past it, future null infinity is where light rays go to, and past null infinity is where it comes from. A boosted massive particle can never get there. It always ends up at this point. Every light rays are going at 45 degrees, so every light ray will cross it at some finite time. So this is a massive geodesic. And then we have a radial electric field pointing out from here. And now, let's suppose we take that formula and I'm going to define here retarded time, which is t minus r, and advanced time, which is t plus r. So let me consider taking electric field and evaluating it at infinity in two ways. One is I hold u fixed and vary r, take r out to infinity. So I go up to here and then back to here. This point is spatial infinity. In the other case, I want to go down first, and then I go up. So if I look back at this formula, what I have to do is I have to get rid of t. And so I will be writing t as either u minus r or v plus r. And so there'll be various signs that will be introduced here. And then when I take r to infinity, I get a different result. So if I go to any point up here, I get this expression, 1 minus v squared, where v is the velocity of the particle, r minus the velocity inner product with x squared. Now, so these signs are different. Notice that when the velocity is 0, the two expressions are the same, but when the velocity is non-zero, they're just different. And now x is of order r, so both these terms are of order 1 over r squared, but they have a different angular dependence on the sphere at infinity. However, they have the property that if I change x to minus x, in other words, I go from this point to the antipodal point over here, these formulas transform into one another. So this expression obeys, if I take the radial electric field up here, it's equal to, so some more notation here, scry plus minus is the past of future null infinity. It's not the same sphere as scry minus plus, which is the future of past null infinity. And we have to distinguish between those because things are rather singular here. So the fields are not smooth here. So what they do obey is this antipodal matching condition. And OK, this is known to experts on this kind of subject, but but wasn't known to me until recently. And you can show, it's not too much work, it's just a linear problem. If we have any collection of moving charges, this condition is obeyed, even if they interact and charges exchanged and so on, even if you have non-trivial scattering. Okay. Now, this may seem like this all seems sort of trivial, but all of a sudden we're going to be led to what seems like a surprising consequence. And so clearly, since this thing is equal to, this is equal to this at these points, if I take the electric field and I integrate it over the sphere, either scribe plus minus or scribe minus plus, convoluted with any function, I will get, since the integrands are equal, the integrals must be equal, convoluted with any function. So I have a quantity associated with the past, an integral down here, and a quantity associated with the future up here, which are exactly equal. Now, if we take this to be a constant and we use Gauss's law, we can write the integral at infinity in the past as an integral over all of past null infinity. That gives us the sum of the incoming charges using Gauss's law. And similarly, the future one, I write it as an integral over future infinity. That's the outgoing charges. So for the particular case of epsilon equals 1, we recover something that everybody in this room knows, that in any scattering process, the sum of the incoming charges is equal to the sum of the outgoing charges. The surprising thing is that this formula is equally true for any function epsilon. We didn't have to choose epsilon equals 1, and we get a conservation law for any function epsilon on the sphere. So what are these conservation laws when epsilon is not constant? Well, we can still use Gauss's law to integrate by parts and take the integral down here and write it as an integral over the past. We can still use Gauss's law to do that, but now we get an extra term. So the first term, we get all the incoming charges weighted by an arbitrary function of the angle. Now that can't possibly be equal to the outgoing charges weighted by an arbitrary function of the angle. And it's not, because there is an extra term, which is kind of a strange duck. It's not something you're used to seeing. And here's what it looks like. You get an extra term when you integrate by parts, and the derivative hits this function epsilon, which is no longer constant. And we have to integrate that over all of past null infinity. And so what is this extra term? We could put an e to the I omega v here, in here. If we did, it would be some frequency omega component of the electromagnetic field, because we're integrating over all advanced time. But there is no e to the I omega v, so this is a kind of a zero mode. It's a zero energy thing, which, for reasons which will become apparent shortly, I'm going to call a soft photon. And the nature of this contraction is saying this derivative of epsilon is appearing here like a polarization vector. And so it's a soft photon with polarization dA epsilon. Now, this is a word about quantum word. A photon is a quantum object. But at the classical level, this is an exact conservation law, which equates some sum of the zero mode of the incoming electromagnetic field and added to it the incoming charge contribution to its antipodal outgoing counterpart. So there is already a definite infinite number of conservation laws in classical 19th century electromagnetism in Minkowski space. Now, what is the quantum conservation law? Well, the quantum, in a quantum theory, we have an S matrix, S. We act on it on some incoming state. We get an outgoing state. And the quantum conservation law is that the S matrix commutes with the conserved charge. And this is an identity for any pair of states in and out and any function epsilon. So it's an infinite number of conservation law. Given any amplitude, we can construct another amplitude which is related to it by this conservation law. So remember, this charge here has two pieces. The strange duck, which is a time integral of the electromagnetic field, and at the quantum level, this operator is going to create and annihilate photons with zero energy. And the other term is just going to become a number which acts on the incoming state in a way that depends on not only the charges of the incoming particles, but the angle that they come in with from. So it relates, it sets up an equality between a, if we take the soft photon part of it, that adds an extra soft photon to whatever S matrix element we were considering, and it's equal to a number times the original S matrix element. Okay, so this sounds extremely bizarre. It would be amazing after QED has been studied for almost 100 years if we found some new relationship relating amplitudes in quantum electrodynamics. And of course, we haven't. All we've done is it's 10 pages of algebra to show that, to rewrite this, go to a momentum space basis, and to show that this relationship here is exactly the soft photon theorem, which was discovered half a century ago. We can also reverse the logic. We can start with the soft photon theorem, which was originally proven using Feynman diagrammatics. And we can start with the soft photon theorem, and we can show that it implies the existence of an infinite number of conserved charges. They are mathematically equivalent statements. Now, whenever you have a conservation law or a conserved charge, you expect a symmetry. So to go from symmetries to conservation laws, you use Noether's theorem. Here we've started with the conservation law. We want to get the symmetry. What is the symmetry? Well, what you do, we've got the charge, so we just do a canonical decomposition of the asymptotic fields at scry, and we just take the charge operator and we take its commutators and ask what it generates. And what it generates is gauge transformations, which usually one talks either about gauge transformations which go to zero at infinity. Those are trivial, redundant symmetries of the theory, or ones which just go to a constant at infinity that doesn't depend on angle. What we have here is gauge transformations which depend, if you go to future null infinity, they go to a constant, which depends on, in an arbitrary way on the angle, but is independent of the retarded time. So they're large gauge transformations. They don't go to zero to infinity. And if we go to past null infinity, they also don't die off, but the thing that they go to is antipodally related to what they do at future null infinity, and that is, of course, related to the antipodal matching condition that we talked about on the third slide. Now, you could also have derived this in another way. You could have, in fact, that's how we discovered it, rather, was doing an asymptotic analysis like the one that Bondi, Messner, and Sachs did for electromagnetism, and ask what the asymptotic symmetries are, and that's how these things were. These are the analog of the Bondi, Messner, Sachs supertranslations for electromagnetism, and that's how they were first discovered. But I think the way I just presented it is everything following from the boundary conditions at infinity has fewer assumptions and is more rigorous and systematic. And there's also an analog of the gravitational memory effect for electromagnetism. Now, one of the implications of this is that the vacuum in QED or any abelian gauge theory is infinitely degenerate. So as we just saw, these charges commute with the Hamiltonian. So if I have one state which is annihilated by the Hamiltonian, I can get another state which is annihilated by the Hamiltonian by acting on it with the charge. The charge certainly does not annihilate the vacuum. That would contradict the self-photon theorem. We just computed what it does. And therefore, these states have different angular momentum. Q plus on the vacuum has different angular momentum. On zero, different angular momentum. And so these states must be orthogonal, not the same state. We can think of it as the vacuum state with an additional soft photon. Alternately, in the classical picture, we can say that the vacuum is not invariant under these large gauge symmetries, and the soft photon is the Goldstone boson of the vacuum's not invariant means that the symmetry is spontaneously broken, and the soft photons are the Goldstone boson. So there are many degenerate vacua in abelian gauge theory, and they have different angular momentum. And so we can say that the quantum vacuum has soft hair. It has some distinguishing characteristics. Not all vacua are the same. Now, so this is a whole story. This whole triangle is about the infrared sector of, in this case, gauge theory. And there's a very salient feature of quantum abelian gauge theories in the deep infrared, which has kind of been a thorn in the side of quantum field theorists for a very long time. And that's the problem of infrared divergences. And so we have something new to say about, or a new way of thinking about the infrared structure of abelian gauge theory. And so what does that have to say about the problem of infrared divergences? We wrote a paper. We've been thinking about this for some time, and it's quite a confusing subject. And I think we have sorted it out, and we posted a paper on it last week. And I think the answer is extremely simple. The answer is there are no infrared divergences in quantum electrodynamics. What happens is that there are no infrared divergences in quantum electrodynamics. What happens is that if you take, like, say, Baba scattering, and there's a diagram where you exchange a soft photon, this diagram has an infrared divergence in it when this exchange photon goes to zero energy. So this diagram is infinite, but we have to sum over all such diagrams, all such ladder diagrams with arbitrary numbers of exchange photons, and that exponentiates the divergence. And instead of this matrix element being infinite, it becomes zero, because you get an exponential of minus the divergence, and so the S matrix element is zero. This is a well-known result. Essentially every scattering amplitude that is computed in every textbook in abelian gauge theory is zero because of infrared divergences. Now, the usual remedy for this is to talk not about scattering amplitudes, but about inclusive cross sections, where you sum over all photons below some infrared cutoff. That's the standard sort of working textbook answer, but there's another story about scattering amplitudes, which has some literature on it, going back to Fadeyev-Kulish and even earlier. So I want to say that these scattering amplitudes are zero because they had to be zero because they violate the conservation law that I wrote on the previous few pages. So they had better be zero. And this was quantum field theory made them zero. Now, in usual textbooks on quantum field theory, for the amplitudes, one doesn't account for a shift in the vacuum state, in the degenerate vacuum. And in fact, the conservation law, if you look at it, tells you that in every non-trivial scattering process, the vacuum must shift. And that is essentially one way of reading the soft formula. It's telling you the difference between the initial and the final vacuum, the beginning and the end of the scattering process. So what we did was understand how to incorporate this vacuum shift, and showed that when you incorporate this vacuum shift, that all the scattering amplitudes are infrared finite. And we didn't have to do a whole lot of work to do this, because we realized that mathematically, though the words that are said are different, mathematically what we've done is reinterpret some old work of Fadeyev and Kulish, who talked about an alternate basis of states where they dress incoming and outgoing particles with clouds of soft photons that had poles in them. And what those poles, the clouds of soft photon, are doing is precisely shifting the vacuum. Sort of the hard diagrammatic work of showing that all the infrared divergence cancels was done in the 60s and 70s. And it was known that there is sort of a basis in which there aren't infrared divergences in abelian gauge theory. But I think a physical understanding of what that basis meant it comes very nicely within this framework I'm presenting here. Okay, so it's all ditto for gravity. And in fact, the gravity case was really understood oddly before quantum electrodynamics. There's a Newtonian potential in general relativity, which, like the radial component of the electromagnetic field, is antipodally matched. There's an infinite number of conserved supertranslation charges, which are characterized by a function on the sphere. The matrix element, the quantum conservation law, is equivalent to Weinberg's 1965 soft graviton theorem. And those charges generate a symmetry, which is a kind of diagonal subgroup, antipodally identified diagonal subgroup of the BMS group, acting on scribe plus and scribe minus. And there's an infinite degeneracy of vacua, which the gravitational memory effects are now proposing, memory experiments are now proposing to measure. And even though it's more indices and technically more complex, the gravity case was understood before the abelian gauge theory case. Okay, so now I'm going to go on to talk about the black hole information paradox. So I will give a lightning review of that paradox, and then talk about how these ideas affect it. Okay, so what is the paradox? So you make a black hole, usually by collapsing graduate students, maybe with their theses, which may or may not have information in them, or you have some stars, or a clock, physics textbooks. Okay, so now you make a black hole. There's a so-called no-hair theorem, which says that within essentially the light crossing time of the black hole settles down to a essentially unique state. And then the Hawking evaporation process occurs outside, and negative energy particles go in, positive energy go out. So there's no information in the outgoing Hawking radiation about what made up the black hole. So there's no information in this. At the end of the day, the system reverts to a unique vacuum, and there's nowhere in either up here at the end or in the Hawking radiation for the information to come out. And so Hawking argues information is destroyed. Now, I don't think there has been, a lot of people have wanting to get out of this paradox, questioned various assumptions as a way to get out of the paradox. So people have questioned whether physics is really local on the scale of the black hole, or they've questioned whether the equivalence principle holds at event horizon, because they don't like the conclusion. Nobody likes the conclusion. Well, there are two people, Bob Wald and Bill Unruh, who think that determinism is as far as I know, two people admit to thinking that determinism is violated. It just doesn't look very nice, but nobody really knows. So now I think we have a reason which came not from trying to solve this problem, but from the previous considerations that indicate that there are several flaws in this argument. The first thing is, there's general agreement that black holes must carry any conserved charge that is measured by a surface integral at infinity. Otherwise, you just get a contradiction. There is a memory of the electric charge. There's a memory of the energy. And those were thought to be all the hair that a black hole can carry, all the quantum numbers that characterize a black hole. But now we've learned that there are an infinite number of conserved charges that that are absolutely conserved, and you can throw them into a black hole. Therefore, a black hole must have some way of carrying them, and so there is a subtle amount, subtle hair on a black hole. Another way of saying this is that the no-hair theorem, which is a mathematical theorem, says that all black holes are diffeomorphic to Kerr. But that's not enough for there to be physically no hair, because some diffeomorphisms are non-trivial. Right? Nobody would say that a stationary black hole is the same as a boosted black hole. They differ by a diffeomorphism, but the boosted black hole carries a different energy. Those are not the same object. Now we've learned that there are infinitely many diffeomorphisms which act non-trivially and can give you physically inequivalent black hole spacetimes. Moreover, since the vacuum is infinitely degenerate, there's an infinite amount of energy, of information that can in principle be stored in the final vacuum state. And indeed, it's possible for the Hawking radiation to be completely thermal, but correlated with the final vacuum in such a way that the whole thing is a pure state. So both of these possibilities are neglected in Hawking's original argument and clearly invalidated, though it may be that possible that there's some way to some modification of the argument which could take this into account and we could get back to where we were, but that has not happened so far. Okay, so we found a flaw in the assumptions underlying the information loss argument. Just to be clear, we haven't resolved the information paradox. It's a very dangerous statement to say you've resolved the information paradox, so I want to be clear. But the nature of the flaw suggests that there are some concrete, new things to think about. In other words, we'd like to understand more about, so it's a very surprising thing that a black hole can has more hair and carries information about much more information about what fell into it than we would have previously believed. So we'd like to understand this in more detail and to see how this is possible. So I'm talking here about the super translation charge, I guess, but I could do the same thing for the electric charge that we discussed in more detail. So now there's a conservation law that the incoming super translation charge is, or what we could be just read this as the large gauge charge. The incoming large gauge charge is equal to the outgoing large gauge charge. But in order to write this as a surface integral, to take the boundary integrals and use the constraints and write it as an integral over a surface, I need a Cauchy surface. So the integral over the green surface would not equal to the integral of anything just over scri plus. I need to close that surface when I integrate by parts, otherwise I get a boundary term. And so there's a piece of, if I write the charge as a density, there's a piece that involves an integral over the horizon of the black hole. It's natural to call that the supertranslation charge or the large gauge charge of the black hole. And the conservation law would not equate the incoming, it would equate the incoming charges on here to the sum of the outgoing charges on the horizon and on scri plus. It will generically not be the case that these two things are separately conserved. We need to take them both into account. Now, the structure here is starting to look like holographic structures that we've encountered in other in ADS CFT and in other examples in string theory. in that the integral over the horizon can be written as a surface term over the integral over the over its future boundary, which I call H plus. So the horizon has a boundary. And that is what enables it to have non-trivial charges. Mathematically, if we look at symmetries and charges and so on the horizon, if you don't have a boundary, you can't have a non-trivial contribution to the symplectic form. Okay, that was a technical aside. Okay, so now, how does this work? Well, if I take a black hole with no charges and I throw an asymmetric shockwave in it and it settles back down, what will happen, one way of thinking about this, is the affine parameters along all the generators of the horizon, if I synchronize them and I then throw in a shockwave and look later on, they will no longer be synchronized in the same way. They will be super translated relative to one another. That is one way of thinking how a super translation changes the structure of a black hole. And in fact, there are super translation charges, and there's something else called super rotation charges, which I talked about a little bit this morning, one of which is angular momentum. And you can we derived a formula for the super translation charges carried by a super rotation charges carried by a super translated black hole. So the point here is that even at the classical level, there are conserved charges, an infinite number of conserved charges, one of which is angular momentum, which differentiate between different kinds of black hole. So even a black hole which is diffeomorphic to Schwarzschild can carry non-zero angular momentum. If you take a black hole which is diffeomorphic to Schwarzschild, say initially with no angular momentum, and then you super translate it, which you can think of either physically by sending in some asymmetric matter, or just mathematically act on the spacetime with a super translation, you can get something with non-zero angular momentum. Now, this may seem to contradict what you read in your general relativity textbooks, but experts in general relativity have long known that it was called the problem of angular momentum in general relativity. Even the vacuum can be given, by acting on it with a super translation, can be given angular, can acquire angular momentum, not just black holes. And this really bothered people. It was called, had a name, the problem of angular momentum. Mathematicians like my colleague Yao and so on have been trying for decades to give a mathematical definition of angular momentum that would always vanish for the vacuum. And there isn't one, for the simple reason that the vacuum can carry angular momentum. And angular momentum is just part of an infinite dimensional group, this much bigger BMS group. So the statement that something which is diffeomorphic to Schwarzschild black hole not only does not contradict what we know about general relativity, but it explains what was thought to be a puzzle. It solves what was called the problem of angular momentum in general relativity. Now, the same is true for an evaporating black hole. So here's the Penrose diagram for an evaporating black hole. At early times, it looks just like a classical black hole. If you wait long enough, it disappears. Hawking quanta come out and it disappears. And this is also constrained by conservation laws. If we look at some retarded, if we take any surface, we must get the same, we can evaluate the charge here, and then we can integrate by parts over any surface which has this region, this two-sphere as a boundary. So we can look at the charge before the black hole starts to evaporate. That has to equal the charge after it evaporates. And or we could go at some intermediate time. It'd have to be equal to the sum of the charges that have come out plus whatever is left on the black hole. So these all gives an infinite number of constraints on the process of Hawking evaporation of a black hole. So in conclusion, black holes have a much richer structure than we had previous, as does Minkowski space, has a much richer structure than we previously understood. There are some degrees of freedom that can be thought of as living on the horizon of the black hole, which store some information about what went into it. Now, in order to solve the information problem, we'd have to show that this phenomena can keep track of all the information. It may or may not do this. This may be some or all of the information puzzle. We just don't know right now how it will flesh out, but I think it is an interesting challenge for future research. I'm done.
So I have a question. So in order to solve this black hole information paradox, so if you send these Alice and Bob in, they have a soft hair, the software will grow on the black hole. I get that. But if you have the hard mode, how do you translate this hard mode into the soft hair? Like if I have hard hair, like how does it transform into the soft hair?
You're asking me if I've solved the information puzzle.
No, but any possibility of like just doesn't have to solve it completely, but just the mechanism of transforming your hard mode into a soft mode, or reversely, like because in the situation that we consider it, like have we ever have a situation that the soft mode actually come to become hard mode or affect the I'm not sure if I'm saying
well. The soft modes and the hard modes are coupled in a very intricate way.
Right.
And a question I'm thinking about now is let's consider a simple case, and we have examples of theories like this in string theory, where there are no stable massive particles. Or we could even make it even simpler. We could say the only stable particle is a graviton. Then you could ask, that's sort of the simplest thing to start off with. Then you could ask, suppose we have an incoming state on scry consisting of gravitons. So then there should be an S matrix in which incoming and outgoing states should be a unitary S matrix, whether or not black holes are formed, in which incoming and outgoing states are all gravitons. Then you can ask the question, to what extent is such a state completely specified by its charges? And there are a lot of these charges, and we aren't even sure we know all of them now, but it seems to be that's something I'm trying to understand now. That would be a more kind of precise, trying to make precise the question that you're asking. But a priori, if you have an infinite number of charges, that's more than enough. You only need, if the black hole has a finite entropy, you only need a finite number of charges. Now, to completely specify the scattering. Now, presumably, the charges that involve sub-Planckian structure can't really come into play. There's some kind of cutoff there. But, an infinite, just at the level of counting, an infinite number of charges is enough. The question is whether, they're giving you redundant information or not. So that's a very interesting question, and one that one can address in a very concrete way.
Would you say that an electron, purely thought of as an object in QED, carries entropy because there are so many of these infinite charges that we don't see?
No, I definitely wouldn't say that. I mean, well, there's the spin, but okay. But we could think about if you take in our papers. We're interested in how you actually physically make a black hole that carries these various charges. And we showed that a typical situation would be, a nice way to do it is to throw in a null shockwave, which has to have some angular dependence to excite the non-trivial harmonics of the charges. Now, if you threw such a wave into a star rather than a black hole, it would sort of plow into the star. Maybe some of the charges would get radiated off, but a lot of them would stick on the star. And so the star can carry these various conserved charges, like the large gauge charge. It can carry that. Now, that's not very surprising because we think of a star as something with a lot of internal degrees of freedom. Now, suppose you throw that same wave, which carries all kinds of charges, at an electron. The electron can't absorb the charges. The shock wave carrying the charges, even if you focus it on the electron, it will just pass through and bring the charges back out to infinity again. So the electron can't hold the charge. If you throw it into a black hole, it will plow into the black hole, and the black hole can hold the charges. So in this sense, a black hole is acting more like, we can already see at the classical level, a black hole acting like something with many degrees of freedom than an elementary particle. Now, there are also ways in which black holes are different from stars, but at least in this limited sense, So you can't stick those charges onto an electron.
So is it simply because the electron is a point particle?
It's because it's a point particle. Yeah.
Has anyone or you made any progress on generalizing this to different conformal structure theory, like de Sitter, anti de Sitter, or a space like or time like de Sitter null?
Well, I guess in a way I would think of this as a generalization from anti de Sitter to Minkowski. And that can actually be made more precise. So a lot of this was inspired by the whole ABS-CFT story, where you have some kind of boundary structure with a symmetry group, which might be bigger than you thought. And indeed, well, that would be a little too technical. But De Sitter, you know, it's surprising how different these three spaces are, Minkowski, De Sitter, and anti-De Sitter. And De Sitter, and in each case, there are different things that are confusing. There are, of course, a lot of papers on soft theorems in cosmology. And the question is, can we reinterpret the soft theorems in cosmology as symmetries? And I think that, you know, it depends on how you set the problem up. But I think at least that in most applications, the answer is yes, you could set it up, but the charges in the kind of cosmologies that people talk about are always zero. So it's not as interesting of a discussion. But I'm sure there's more to say there. Even that is what I just said isn't in print anywhere. But
so, do I understand correctly that this black hole states with different super translation or super rotation charges, they are related by a large diffeomorphism morphism to each other or not?
Right. So I talked about large gauge symmetries.
Yeah.
I didn't tell you actually about it's such a rich story, I can't explain the whole thing, but I didn't even tell you about all the large gauge symmetries, because there's not only a soft theorem, there's a subleading soft theorem. And then there's a whole nother story associated with that. And in gravity, there are there's a leading soft theorem, a subleading soft theorem, and a sub-subleading soft theorem. And they all have their own stories, and they all have symmetries associated with them, which in some cases are related to diffeomorphisms. So there's a story like the one I gave for the QED for gravity, where instead of large gauge symmetries, you have large diffeomorphisms.
But it is large diffeomorphism. These guys, they're all related to each other by large diffeomorphism.
So even that is not always true.
Okay.
So it turns out that in theories with massless fermions, they're for example, in supersymmetric QED, there's a soft Fotino theorem. And whenever you have a soft theorem, you can reinterpret it as a symmetry. But there was no infinite dimensional fermionic symmetry in supersymmetric QED. So it can happen that you can get asymptotic symmetries without there originally being a local gauge symmetry present.
So, but I guess with that exception, I guess my confusion is that if these infinite number of states that are actually all related by diffeomorphisms, how can an observer distinguish them from each other?
Good question. So, that's kind of the central question, right? So another thing that is related by diffeomorphism is a Schwarzschild black hole and a boosted Schwarzschild black hole.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we wouldn't want to say those things are the same.
Maybe we do. I don't.
I think we don't. They have different energy, right? So if those are the same, there's no notion of energy conservation. So what we do is, one way of thinking about it is, how big is the phase space? Okay, so I would say that you know, the phase space of a black hole, let's ignore rotation, you know, it's six dimensional, right? There's three positions and three velocities. And in the quantum theory, we would like, for example, to be able to consider a superposition of a stationary black hole and a boosted black hole. They're different things. Now how do you, what formalism do you use to distinguish these things? How do you decide when a diffeomorphism isn't trivial? How do you decide when two things which differ by a diffeomorphism are not the same? Well, this, of course, is the question which Bondi, Messner, and Sachs addressed in 1962. They had a particular way of a particular, you know, litmus test of when a diffeomorphism was trivial and when it isn't, which probably people wouldn't be the one they would use now. But I would say, I guess the way I would like to answer the question, first of all, many people have answered this question incorrectly at various times, and I don't know if there is an overreaching definition which not only includes everything that we've already investigated, but everything that we will investigate in the future. We keep discovering new things and we have to change our rules. But certainly one basic ingredient is that there's a natural symplectic form in quantum electrodynamics and in general relativity. And if something is involved, appears, if you have a change in the geometry or the change in the gauge field, and the symplectic form, you know, the division into P's and Q's, is non-zero, then that should be regarded as a physical excitation of the system. And what happens is when you have a gauge symmetry, this is the technical way I would answer your question. If you have a gauge symmetry, if it dies off at infinity, it will always decouple from the symplectic form. But if it goes to a constant at infinity, and this is exactly what happens in the case that I described, there are important boundary terms in the symplectic form, which must be there in order for it to be conserved. And since there are boundary terms in the symplectic form, it's not invariant. The symplectic form is not invariant under gauge transformations or diffeomorphisms which fall off too slowly. And the BMS transformations, the large diffeomorphisms, the super rotations, and these large gauge transformations, can all of these examples I've discussed, these degrees of freedom can be identified as physically non-trivial because they actually enter into the symplectic form. And in some cases, they're paired with gauge invariant excitations. You can have a pure gauge transformation which is symplectically paired with something which involves non-zero field strength or non-zero curvature. So there is some mathematical formalism which people have been hammering away at for a long, long time. But we keep meeting new situations, and there are things that are not fully understood about it.
Do you ever worry that maybe your software is too good at encoding information, and so you'll create an infinite tower of distinct quantum states and run into the same sort of problems people worried about with regards to remnants and the sun not being able to shine because you have too many other states you should be transitioning to in your theory and so forth?
Well, I'm not worried about it. I mean, it's there. Right, so I mean, so that nature must avoid getting into that puzzle.
Yeah. So, is there any sense in what you've been exploring that you can put an upper bound on the entropy or the information encoded in software?
Um, Well, you know, heuristically, one would think that the soft hair in a black hole, that you couldn't resolve the horizon of the black hole into anything that was, you know, smaller than the Planck size. So that should provide a cutoff. But, you know, it's not an abelian group. So it's not, the symmetry group is not an abelian group. So the soft hair isn't just like, to fully understand it, you have to think about representation theory of some group. And, you know, it's not just a simple matter of counting the number of charges, right? Because they, yeah.
Okay, one last question.
Well, your talk was so clear that it suggested a large number of questions, probably comparable to the number of soft conserved quantities. But Dominic told me I can only ask one that has a very short answer. So I'll stick with the historical question. There were two things that people worried about in connection with QED that and gravity that vaguely resemble what you're telling us. So the question is, do you see any connection? One was some old work where people said that in QCD, Lorentz invariance is broken by some sort of QED, that's a QED Lorentz invariance. I think it was Strokey, I forget exactly who wrote that text, by some infrared effect. And the other one is in gravity, which is the Newman-Penrose conserved quantity, which have a similar kind of character to what you're saying. That's one's leading order and one. Higher orders of fallout and scribe. So.
Are you talking about the infinite number of ones or the 10 in general relativity? Or
either. Let's take the finite number.
Okay. So, yes, there was, and Balachandran also worked on this.
Right.
Yeah. So there was some work where people were barking up the same tree, and they were looking at gauge transformations that, and I think it probably ultimately leads to the same place. They were looking at space-like slices, and they had gauge transformations which were not antipodally matched, and that would be inconsistent. That wouldn't give a, they were motivated by the same thoughts. I just think they were missing a few pieces. So I think it's ultimately the same thing. One could say I slightly modified and completed their program. And certainly they used words like, didn't they? I think they talked about vacuum degeneracy. They certainly talked about Lorentz invariance being spontaneously broken, which would. And then, what was your second question?
Newman-Penrose,
yeah. So Newman-Penrose wrote a, one of the reasons that this structure was missed was that in most of the relativity literature up to Christodoulou and Kleinerman, there was a simplifying assumption. Certainly, in almost everything that Penrose did, there was this conformal compactification, and in general, you cannot conformally compactify space-time in the manner that Penrose wanted to, unless all of these charges that I mentioned vanish. And so it's an extremely non-generic situation in which all of these charges vanishes. For example, if you just have two point masses coming in at infinity, coming in with no incoming radiation, all the charges will generically be non-zero. So that case is excluded. The scattering of two stars is excluded in Penrose's discussion. So And also related work, so most of the discussion in general relativity, most of the literature in general relativity, most of the textbooks in general relativity only consider the special case where these charges vanish. Now, one of the things that you can prove if the charges don't vanish, in the generic case, if these charges vanish, you have something called the peeling theorems, which tell you how the vial tensor fall off near null infinity in a spacetime which can be conformally compactified. The peeling theorems, Chris DiDullo helped me understand this, but the peeling theorems just are not valid in a generic situation. And indeed, I saw a paper by some astrophysicists who were doing colliding of stars, and they, at the end of their paper, saying, we must have made a mistake because our answer doesn't obey the peeling theorem. That's how it's kind of ubiquitous, this sense is. Not that anything wrong was said. So Penrose's 10 conserved charges are a property of, they give you a sense of how incredibly restrictive Penrose's asymptotic boundary conditions is. Those charges are conserved only for this very special class of spacetimes, which are a set of measure zero. So physically, I think they're uninteresting. And they're unrelated to these charges, which operate in a generic physical situation.
Okay.